From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
When we first arrived at Camp David, the first thing upon which we agreed was to ask the people of the world to pray that our negotiations would be successful. Those prayers have been answered far beyond any expectations.
That was then-President Jimmy Carter, 36 years ago Wednesday, at a ceremony marking the signing of the Camp David Peace Accord between Israel and Egypt. President Carter expressed the high hopes that the parties and the world had at the time for peace in Palestine.
The questions that have brought warfare and bitterness to the Middle East for the last 30 years will not be settled overnight. But we should all recognize the substantial achievements that have been made. One of the agreements that President Sadat and Prime Minister Begin are signing tonight is entitled A Framework for Peace in the Middle East.
Fast forwarding 36 years, the situation for Palestinians is worse now than it's ever been, with the UN Middle East envoy warning that, after this past summer's siege, Gaza could implode again. Jocelyn Sambera reports from the United Nations.
The crisis in Gaza is far from over, and the window of opportunity to address critical needs and stabilize the situation is short. That's what Robert Suri, the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, told members of the Security Council on Tuesday. Gaza could implode again, and the two-state solution for Israel and Palestine could slip irreversibly away, Suri warned. He assured the council he was not crying wolf and urged them not to underestimate the dangers.
The devastation unleashed by this most recent round of conflict has left civilians on both sides feeling once again battered and embittered. Yet the interdependence of these two peoples has only been deepened, not lessened, by the latest disaster. If they fall into a new round of violence, they will be even more intertwined, yet even more distrustful in its surely appalling aftermath. We, they, all of us must act now and set a wiser and more responsible course.
Suri said he hoped the Council would also have the occasion to make its own position on the issue clear. Fresh thinking was needed from the parties and the international community, the special envoy noted, to end the current dynamics and retain the two-state solution. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
A private German fraud investigation firm announced Wednesday that one of its clients is offering a $30 million bounty to anyone who helps identify the perpetrators of the downing of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 in eastern Ukraine last July, which killed all 298 people aboard. The investigation company, WIFKA, based in Schleswig-Holstein, Germany, said it has been retained to investigate the case. WIFKA said in a statement on its website, quote, "After the terrible assassination or accident, all political parties, at home and abroad, said they owed it to the victims, their families, and the public to clarify the circumstances of the crash and present evidence for what happened. None of this has yet been done," closed quote. 2 months have passed since the Malaysia Airlines plane on its way from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur was shot down in eastern Ukraine. A preliminary report into the disaster carried out by Dutch investigators issued on September 9th said that the crash was a result of structural damage caused by a large number of high-energy objects which struck the Boeing plane from the outside. WIFKA said that the client, who preferred to stay anonymous, will pay $30 million to whomever provides evidence that identifies those behind the shootdown. It said the money has been securely deposited in Zurich and will be paid there or in a place of the whistleblower's choosing, adding that the client offering the bounty also offered to give the whistleblower a new identity if necessary. As China's President Xi Jinping visited India to deepen relations between the two Asian giants, the 2014 China ASEAN Expo opened in the Chinese city of Nanning. This year's conference is crucially timed with China-ASEAN efforts to establish what's being called the 21st Century Maritime Silk Road. Li Yang, vice chair of the China Association of International Trade, spoke with China's CCTV about the highlights of the conference.
I think there are three elements that explains the appeal. One is that the Expo has been has become a recognized platform for win-win cooperation, and that platform provides a lot of business opportunities for business people attending the Expo over the last 10 years. And secondly, I think it is an important carrier of trade facilitation, because this is a platform also for business people and for government officials to discuss, for example, the improvement, the liberalization of the trade and investment. And thirdly, I think it has become an engine that drives, for example, the cooperation in multiple areas, when especially this is an occasion for business people, for investors to meet. Talking about the highlights, I think probably there are another three highlights that we can expect, actually. One is the new theme. Obviously, this new theme for this expo is the 21st Century Silk Road. And the second one, I think, is the new services. As the expo unfolds, people will be exposed to new services as provided by the expo. For example, apart from the exhibition of commodities, there will be trade facilitation services, logistical services, legal services, and so on. And then the third, I think it is very interesting highlights. As you know, that Australia has been invited as a VIP country, and that signals that the Expo is now thinking about the 10+6 under the framework for RCEP, rather than the current 10+1. So I think this is also heralds the Expo's vision to provide kind of a bigger space for the future participants of the Expo.
All right. Now, the China-ASEAN Free Trade Area has become an important platform to promote an economic exchange between China and ASEAN. In what spectrum can we expect the two sides will continue to deepen cooperation in the future?
Yeah, one of the most important thing that has been discussed between China and ASEAN is the upgrading of the free trade zone, free trade agreement. I think what we can expect in terms of cooperation is in the trade facilitation area. And second, which is also very important, as I mentioned earlier, is the cooperation in the construction or building of the 21st Silk Road, notably the economic corridor, China-Singapore Economic Corridor. And thirdly, I think we can expect a lot of cooperation in the construction of the infrastructure along the corridor, and the effort to improve connectivity, for example, in terms of transportation, in terms of finance, in terms of trade. Okay, and lastly, I think, there will be a lot of opportunities for cooperation between the two sides in the process of the ASEAN economic integration.
They're both major oil-producing countries that have used their oil revenues to make heavy investments in the needs of their own people. They're both the targets of U.S. sanctions and U.S. foreign policy in general, and they've both decided that they're stronger working together than acting alone. Venezuela and Iran launched their 8th joint commission on Tuesday, aimed at deepening cooperation between the two countries. The commission will focus on improving links in the areas of industry, science, technology, health, energy, agriculture, housing, and bilateral trade, as well as culture, sports, education, and youth exchanges. In Caracas, Venezuelan Foreign Minister Rafael Ramirez called the commission, quote, an extraordinary mechanism to solidify different areas of cooperation between our peoples, closed quote. Venezuela and Iran currently have 265 bilateral agreements, but the foreign minister said more cooperation between the two nations is essential. Ramirez vowed that the commission will deliver far-reaching improvements to bilateral ties, particularly in the oil industry. He said that with Iran's help, Venezuela aims to, quote, overcome all the deformations of oil profiteering, closed quote. The two countries currently have about 40 joint projects under development in the oil sector. Brazil's third televised presidential debate was held Tuesday night as the candidates sought to win over voters ahead of the October 5th general election. Eight candidates participated, but the three candidates leading in the polls, incumbent President Dilma Rousseff and challengers Marina Silva and Osio Nieves, were in the spotlight. Rousseff is ahead in the polls, but the race is likely to go to a second round. The main issues discussed were health, poverty, corruption, reform, and economic policies. Marina Silva is Rousseff's main rival. She said on several occasions that her government would be made up of, quote, the best people, closed quote, from all parties. Silva said she would free up resources by returning to efficiency in public spending, a message she has pushed throughout the campaign. This is widely seen locally as an attempt to win over market investors opposed to the greater role played by Brazil's government in the nation's economy over the past three presidential terms. President Rousseff rejected Silva's proposals and warned that it was a recipe for, quote, powerful people to rule from behind the scenes, closed quote. Defending her economic record, Rousseff emphasized that, quote, we've taken 35 million people out of poverty between my government and that of President Lula, closed quote. Silva was forced to acknowledge the successful and widely popular programs implemented by the Rousseff government and the two previous presidential terms of her predecessor, President Lula da Silva. She said she would maintain many of the landmark policies, but critics have pointed out that this would be difficult to reconcile with her promise to reduce public sector spending.
I declare open the 69th regular session of the General Assembly.
That was Uganda's Foreign Minister, Sam Kutesa, this year's President of the UN General Assembly, opening the 69th session of the Assembly at the UN's headquarters in New York City. Kutesa was the unanimous choice of the African Union's Executive Council for the post after Cameroonian Foreign Minister Pierre Moukoko withdrew from the running. Kutesa will serve until September 2015. World leaders will descend on New York over the next week to kick off the Assembly's work for the coming year. We will be covering this through the end of the opening session later this month.
Hello, McDill! I want to thank General Austin for his introduction. Lloyd, for your exceptional leadership. Were you about to sneak off the stage?
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was. Yes,
sir. That was President Barack Obama Wednesday at MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, discussing his plans for the latest U.S. operations in Iraq, which are also slated to involve Syria. The president seemed to backpedal from comments made Tuesday by the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, who, while testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee Tuesday, appeared to unambiguously put the option of U.S. ground troops on the table.
One of the things we've learned over this last decade is America can make a decisive difference. But I want to be clear, the American forces that have been deployed to Iraq do not and will not have a combat mission. They will support Iraqi forces on the ground as they fight for their own country against these terrorists. As your commander-in-chief, I will not commit you and the rest of our armed forces to fighting another ground war in Iraq. After a decade of massive ground deployments, it is more effective to use our unique capabilities in support of partners on the ground so they can secure their own country's futures. And that's the only solution that will succeed over the long term.
The president also detailed some of the division of labor in the coming fighting, including this statement about the joint role between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia in training anti-government forces for the war in Syria.
Overall, more than 40 countries so far have offered assistance to the broad campaign against ISIL. Some nations will assist from the air, and already France and the United Kingdom are flying with us over Iraq, with others committed to join this effort. Some nations will help us support the forces fighting these terrorists on the ground. And already Saudi Arabia has agreed to host our efforts to train and equip Syrian opposition forces.
Elias Shazdi is a political analyst based in San Juan, Puerto Rico. In an interview with Press TV Wednesday, he said that failing to work in coordination with the Syrian government and instead providing $500 million in military aid to anti-government forces in Syria was counterproductive.
Well, it's certainly a backfiring policy by the United States not to request the help or the cooperation, collaboration of Syria, which is the Syrian government, the one most threatened by ISIS and by other Al-Qaeda groups like the Al-Nusra Front, which, by the way, receives support from the U.S., from Saudi Arabia, from Qatar. And that is the problem, you see. The United States, at the same time that it's preaching, is saying that they are going to destroy the ISIS, they are going to approve $500 million to train, equip, and supply the insurgent groups in Syria, which I would call them better terrorist groups, and especially the most radical ones, like the Islamics, like the ISIS, which is not the only radical group among the Syrian terrorists and insurgents. There are others too, like the Al-Nusra Front or the Islamic Front. So that is the problem, that even if they would defeat one, others will replace the one defeated. Why? Because they are receiving support from the United States. Now, maybe they are not directly receiving support, and they will not directly receive support from those $500 million in terms of training and supplies and weapons, etc. But according to sources, like one fundraiser that operates in Qatar, in this Arab Persian Gulf state, what they do, he said that what he was doing is that he would buy with Arab Persian Gulf money, which is a lot, from the Syrian insurgency, he said, quoting the New York Times, military consuls, he would buy the weapons and supplies that they get from outside, and then he would resold or supply that help from abroad to groups like the Al-Nusra Front linked to Al-Qaeda, and that's precisely what might be happening with ISIS, that they might not be receiving directly the help from the United States, but some of the Persian Gulf middlemen, Arab ones, of course, wealthy Arabs, will be buying it to give it to them. $500 million of help from the United States, that surely some of it is going to end in the hands of ISIS, and so the problem is not going to end. It's going to continue, and perhaps it's going to grow.
And a piece in Wednesday's New York Times laid out another potential contradiction facing the U.S. policy towards Syria. According to the Times, a broad group of non-ISIS anti-government insurgents in Syria say the Syrian government appears to be stepping up its attacks on them ahead of the threatened American air campaign against ISIS in Syria. Both pro-government and anti-government analysts say Syria's president, Bashar al-Assad, has an interest in eliminating the non-ISIS rebels to make sure that government forces are the only ones left to benefit on the ground from any weakening of the ISIS forces by U.S. attacks. President Assad has maintained from the start of the conflict in 2011 that he and his allies are the only force in Syria capable of battling the insurgents effectively. Almost in confirmation of this, ISIS members in Homs said Wednesday that there had been no recent government attacks against the group, adding to their suspicions that the Syrian government is focused on attacking the other groups while letting the U.S. and its allies take on ISIS. President Obama's offensive in Iraq and Syria, quote, brings humanity closer to world war than we have been maybe in 80 years, closed quote. That, according to scholar and activist Dr. Anthony Montero. Montero called Obama's arming of so-called moderate Syrian rebels a farce. He spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford.
He is bringing us to the brink of global war because Syria is not Libya. Syria is not even Iraq. Syria has allies that neither of those countries had. In fact, the attack upon Syria is an attack upon Iran and is an attack, in a certain sense, upon Russia, certainly Hezbollah, and it is an attempt to rearrange the political alliances and the military alliances in that region to go forward with the war against the Assad regime in Syria as a step towards Iran. This is dangerous. I think it brings humanity closer to world war than we have been maybe in 80 years.
It seems that Obama is doubling down on his policy of arming, further training these so-called moderate rebels. And there's a consensus, even in the corporate media, that such moderate rebels don't exist.
Precisely. The war in Syria is being won by the government of Syria and its military. The so-called moderates basically ceased to exist outside of press conferences maybe a year ago. They had been defeated primarily by the al-Nusra Front and its allies. And so there is no moderate opposition to the Assad government. It is all extreme, gangster, thuggish militants who are funded by the very people, some of the very nations that are part of the coalition of the willing, Saudi Arabia, Qatar in particular. Now, of course, the hidden hand in all of this is the Israeli government and the Israeli military on the ground in Syria, in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, training these militant jihadists. The big question I think we have to ask, I think everybody's asking, where did this Islamic State, this ISIL, come from in the first place? Suddenly they appear. Clearly, it is a creation of the West, trained and equipped by the Saudis, the Qataris, and the Israelis. And so that's where we are right now.
It also appears that this administration, certainly the corporate media, is investing heavily in painting President Assad as somehow an ally of ISIS, much in the same way that the Bush administration was able to convince lots of Americans that Saddam Hussein of Iraq was a friend of al-Qaeda.
Yeah, well, this is all a part of the great disinformation campaign to justify going to war. The Assad government is a force for stability in that part of the world, a force for progress, and of course part of the axis of resistance, as it is called. If the Assad government falls, then you have chaos and perhaps a government that would be controlled by people like the ISIL and the al-Nusra Front, these extreme gangster jihadists.
The logic of defeating ISIS or ISIL would appear to be to make common cause with Assad, who's been fighting these jihadists of all kinds for the last 3 years. But that goes contrary to U.S. objectives in the region, which are, of course, to overthrow Assad.
And I don't think this thing is about defeating ISIL. I don't think that's what it's about. I think this is about bringing down the Assad regime. Something they failed to do when the Assad government is winning at this point. The other thing is something close to regime change took place in Iraq a week or so ago with the overturning of the Maliki government. Now, I'm no fan of Maliki, but Maliki was aligned with Assad and the Iranians against ISIL and against the U.S. policies there. He had to therefore go. I think the target is the Assad government, not ISIL, and the targeting of the Assad government is the targeting ultimately of Iran and indirectly to create a hostile environment on the southern flank of Russia. And thus they will have hostile forces confronting the Russian government both on Russia's west in Ukraine and on the south from Syria and such.
President Obama's friends among the kings and emirs and other royals of the oil-rich state seem to be in a state of disarray themselves, carrying out a proxy war between each other, certainly in Libya.
I agree with you completely. Unless the objective is to so destabilize North Africa and the Middle East at this point, and then coming in later on, when all of the forces of resistance have been defeated and installing their own regimes. Chaos for the time being, transitioning to regime change down the road. Now, of course, it creates the most dangerous conditions for people, not just in that region, but for the world. Because, again, you are threatening Russia. And with the Putin government saying that they will stand up to this type of aggression. And, of course, the allies of Russia, China, those nations in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, these alliances that are economic but also have a political and military character to them, would stand up and defend themselves against renewed aggression from the Anglo-American organized front of aggression.
A ceasefire is in effect in Ukraine.
Yeah, we have a ceasefire for the time being. We don't know what's down the road. We all know, and everybody admits, it's a temporary ceasefire. The West is imposing, the EU is imposing new sanctions on Russia as we speak. These are hostile sanctions. These are acts of economic warfare against Russia. And we all know that these types of sanctions are only a prelude to a military activity. So I would not feel any way good about this ceasefire. I think it's only temporary. And I think the Obama administration and the U.S. regime, period, is committed to endless war. And the objective is to so transform the planet in such a way that there can be no resistance or questioning of American empire and American hegemony.
So you're saying that a U.S. strategy of chaos is in full effect?
That's right. And I would put chaos and endless war. And you know, Glenn, these types of small wars have generally been preludes to general war. The other thing in this whole equation is the stagnant U.S. economy and the stagnant Western economies. And I don't know, and I don't have any special insight on the thinking of people that run the Western world and the Western economies. But there are some of those who believe that war is good politically and economically. Because, you know, war can be a justification for repression at home, for the limiting of speech, and so on at home. A lot of them believe that war can stimulate economies, get economies out of stagnation and recession. So you get this double movement of economic stagnation and war throughout the world, which in the past has led to fundamental changes to the regime that have initiated the wars themselves. I think we're looking at something that we have not experienced in our lifetimes.
Certainly we have not seen a rapprochement and a growing military as well as economic alliance between Russia and China in very, very, very long time. Is that progressing?
I don't think that China has an option in this matter. The pivot to China or the pivot to Asia of the Obama administration, you know, that pivot can come through the Pacific or it can come through Iran, it can come through the Middle East, coming east rather than just from the west of China. The out for China is an alliance with Russia and with India, in spite of the conservative right-wing government that is running India right now. India doesn't have options outside of an alliance. It has to, in its own interest, in its own self-defense, see some sort of coalition with Russia and China
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.